Imposing limitations on monetary goods has always required tremendous amounts of time and energy and trust. And yet, with all our efforts, we still have been unable to fix the supply of any of the modern monetary assets of the world. Someone, somewhere, has always found a way to increase the supply, whether because of some emergency reason to protect the greater good, or out of sheer greed, or out of complete ignorance, humans have succeeded 100% of the time in debasing the monetary premiums of all goods in all of recorded human history. And then there was Bitcoin. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We are starting off the week with a great little read that came across my feed. This is by Zach of Earth. I don't remember who shared this with me, by the way. And I apologize for whoever that was. I usually try to keep track so I can just be like, oh, somebody mentioned me in this and told me to read this article. But I didn't, so my bad. This is on Zach of Earth's Medium page. I feel like that name is super familiar. Like, I should know who Zach of Earth is. They're not on Twitter anymore. But I can't make a connection. I couldn't find him anywhere else. So that'll be a mystery until I'm sure one of you guys tweets at me and lets me know. But this article came across, and I always love discussions of the 21 million limit. I know we've hit that idea from a lot of different directions. But I just read through this yesterday while I was sitting down going through a bunch of different articles and just thought this would be a fun way to start the week. It got me thinking, made me want to talk. So, boom, we're doing an episode. I will be jumping back into the audiobook for Check Your Financial Privilege from Alex Gladstein. So keep an ear out. I hope to have that one wrapped up soon. We'll announce it on the twits. And if you need something to hold you over, if you're low on Bitcoin audibleness, you can get Jonathan Beer's Block Size War. I was talking to somebody the other day and they did not know about this book. I did the audiobook for this and it's phenomenal. If you haven't read it, it is a incredibly thorough and detailed retelling of everything that happened during the Block Size War and how it all played out and the dynamics involved and the different players. Honestly, it is required reading for Bitcoiners, in my opinion. I will have a link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out. So let's dive into the article. But real fast, I want to thank our amazing sponsors to the show. We have the Fold card, the Sats Back card on everything in your life, and Swan Bitcoin, the place to onboard into Bitcoin. Swan Bitcoin is how you do Bitcoin, and the Fold card is how you do fiat. If you're doing fiat without getting sats back, you're doing it wrong. And also, we are saying goodbye to Bitbox as a show sponsor. I'll be thinking about them every time I break out my Bitbox hardware wallet, and I'll miss getting to talk about the places you shouldn't put it, even though it has rounded corners. But I can't be sad for too long, because we are in the final stages. It's not like super finalized yet, but we have the truly Bitcoin only hardware wallet coming on board, the Cold Card. I'm super stoked to have. I love their team. I love everything they do. And honestly, there are only like four, maybe five hardware wallets that I would readily shill on the podcast. And I have been super lucky to have support from the best. And like I said, it's not finalized, but I'm happy to talk about and show Cold Card with or without it. But it's looking like everything's going to go through. So hopefully I will have a discount code for you guys soon. And when I do, I'm finally going to snag a block clock from CoinKite using my own discount code. That's going to kind of make me feel pretty good about it, honestly. Moscow time! Okay. Enough of that. It is time to get into today's read. And it's titled, 21 Million is Non-Negotiable, by Zach of Earth. The primary innovation of Bitcoin is the fixed supply. This is often missed even by the most voracious and outspoken proponents of the protocol. Sure, the proponents will promote and advocate for the 21 million hard cap, but do they understand that this fixed supply is the primary innovation of Bitcoin? Do the proponents of Bitcoin understand the enormity and the nuance of the artificially imposed fixed supply of Bitcoin? In the entirety of human existence, there has never been a cap on the number of units of any monetary asset or reserve currency utilized by the various cultures of humanity for the past tens of thousands of years. Whether we look at the ancient use of seashells, stones, glass beads, and precious minerals, or the more recent history of precious metals, or the current use of government debts like U.S. Treasury bonds, public equities in the global stock markets, or the myriad of digital currencies like U.S. dollars, British pounds, or Japanese yen, all of these things have been scarce and therefore provided the primary characteristic of money. But there is a vast universe of difference between a scarce supply and a fixed supply. The innovation of Bitcoin is the fixed supply. Everything else about the protocol, the lines of code, and the computers and humans that run that code, is in support of this innovation. Everything else is secondary to the primary innovation, the fixed supply. Quote, commerce on the internet has come to rely almost exclusively on financial institutions serving as trusted third parties to process electronic payments. While the system works well enough for most transactions, it still suffers from the inherent weaknesses of the trust-based model. Completely non-reversible transactions are not really possible, since financial institutions cannot avoid mediating disputes. The cost of mediation increases transaction costs, limiting the minimum practical transaction size and cutting off the possibility for small casual transactions, and there's a broader cost in the loss of ability to make non-reversible payments for non-reversible services. With the possibility of reversal, the need for trust spreads. Merchants must be wary of their customers, hassling them for more information than they would otherwise need. A certain percentage of fraud is accepted as unavoidable. These costs and payment uncertainties can be avoided in person by using physical currency, but no mechanism exists to make payments over a communications channel without a trusted party. Quote from the Bitcoin White Paper. It is extraordinarily difficult to force humans to limit the supply of something that they deem valuable. And with money as the most valuable thing, the most saleable good, the efforts to limit the supply are that much more difficult. Consider a few examples. On currencies, the United States government has special task forces and prisons and complex printing presses designed to limit the production of dollar bills. Billions of dollars are spent every year limiting the supply of dollar bills. People are even murdered for the mere suspicion of creating unauthorized dollar bills. On debts, the United States government holds special votes to decide whether to increase the supply of government bonds with the whole world watching, and there are special private central banks that hold secret meetings to determine whether to buy these bonds and adjust their global values as the changes in these supplies, and thus their price, have enormous global repercussions across all markets. On equities, changes in supplies of shares of corporate equity have massive implications on their market capitalization and shareholder confidence. Special private votes are held to allow for changes in the number of shares issued and outstanding, with state and federal laws enforcing and overseeing such changes. Imposing limitations on monetary goods has always required tremendous amounts of time and energy and trust. And yet, with all our efforts, we still have been unable to fix the supply of any of the modern monetary assets of the world. Someone, somewhere, has always found a way to increase the supply, whether because of some emergency reason to protect the greater good, or out of sheer greed, or out of complete ignorance, humans have succeeded 100% of the time in debasing the monetary premiums of all goods in all of recorded human history. And then there was Bitcoin. Quote, abstract. A purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. The first sentences of the abstract of the Bitcoin white paper. Satoshi solved the double spending problem, but he did so in a way that few understand. Even the most ardent proponents of Bitcoin don't understand his solution, and it is not surprising that the solution is misunderstood because most of these proponents do not understand the problem that was solved. Sure, Satoshi stated in the abstract of his white paper that he had a solution to the double spending problem, but what exactly is the double spending problem? The double spending problem was monetary value loss. The double spending solution was to make monetary value loss impossible. Quote, double spending is a potential flaw in a digital cash scheme in which the same single digital token can be spent more than once. Unlike physical cash, a digital token consists of a digital file that can be duplicated or falsified. As with counterfeit money, such double spending leads to inflation by creating a new amount of copied currency that did not previously exist. This devalues the currency relative to other monetary units or goods and diminishes user trust as well as the circulation and retention of the currency. Double spending defined by Wikipedia. According to Wikipedia, the ability to double spend digital cash is the spending of money more than once, wherein the victim or victims receive less monetary value than what they were led to believe they received. The act of double spending is essentially the same as counterfeiting money or inflating the money supply, a loss of monetary value. Although the methodologies of these actions might be varied, the outcomes are identical. Someone or some group of people have less monetary value after someone else or some other group of people, either knowingly or unknowingly, increase the total supply of monetary units. In other words, the double spending problem was a problem of fixing the denominator such that there was no way to intentionally or accidentally, for a short period of time or for an extended period of time, change the total supply of monetary units in circulation. Said yet another way, the end goal was to find a way to fix the total supply such that there was no possible way for anyone or any group of people to ever change the supply. And in doing so, the double spending problem would be solved. Quote, what is needed is an electronic payment system based on cryptographic proof instead of trust, allowing any two willing parties to transact directly with each other without the need for a trusted third party. Transactions that are computationally impractical to reverse would protect sellers from fraud, and routine escrow mechanisms could easily be implemented to protect buyers. In this paper, we propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer distributed timestamp server to generate computational proof of the chronological order of transactions. The system is secure as long as honest nodes collectively control more CPU power than any cooperating group of attacking nodes. From the last paragraph of the introduction of the Bitcoin white paper. Allow me to restate that opening question. Do the proponents of Bitcoin understand the enormity and the nuance of the artificially imposed fixed supply of Bitcoin? So far, we've covered the enormity, and some of the proponents understand this, We have a first in our species event, a fixed supply monetary good. Pretty enormous occurrence, hard to overstate. But what is the nuance all about? This is the challenging point to grasp, like trying to articulate a brilliant thought that suddenly slipped the mind, never to return. We need to understand the nuance to truly appreciate the enormity. We need to understand the nuance to fully understand why and how the primary innovation of Bitcoin is the fixed supply. The Bitcoin protocol has code that fixes the supply, beginning with 50 Bitcoins every single block. Upon every 210,000 blocks, there is a supply halving of coins. And with 33 halvings, the culminating total issuance of Bitcoin units is just shy of 21 million. A grand total of 20,999,999.976900. Of course, there are also some Bitcoin that may be lost forever because of various technical reasons. Nevertheless, for simplicity's sake, the total is 21 million. So the computers run this code, and that is the total supply. This is simple grade 11 math. Shout out to Greg Foss. But who runs the computers that run the code? Here is the nuance. This is where you and I and our children and our children's children and their children's children step forward and carry the flag. We maintain the honest nodes that Satoshi referenced in the white paper. We are the nuance. We make the conscious decision to keep the supply fixed. Anyone could create a new version of Bitcoin with an increased supply of Bitcoin, explaining all the terrifying reasons why the world will end, why Bitcoin will fail unless we run the new version, the version with an increased supply. As previously noted, whether because of some emergency reason to protect the greater good, or out of sheer greed, or out of complete ignorance, humans have succeeded 100% of the time in debasing the monetary premiums of all goods in all of recorded human history. Not this time. Satoshi has entrusted in us to not debase our own money, and we will carry that flag forever. We are also financially incentivized to not debase our own wealth, so obviously, but not obvious to those that don't own any, we will never increase the supply and debase ourselves. Anyone can create a duplicate of Bitcoin. For example, the United States government could copy the Bitcoin protocol, call it Fedcoin, and force everyone in the United States to use Fedcoin instead of their US dollars. So now there are two Bitcoin protocols, each with a fixed supply of 21 million units. So actually there are now 42 million units, right? Right? No, wrong, doofus. Now there are still only 21 million Bitcoin units. There are still hundreds of thousands of people around the world that will never run a Bitcoin protocol that has changed the number of Bitcoin units that was defined in 2009 with version 0.1.0 of the protocol. The act of creating a copy of the Bitcoin protocol, changing the name and changing some specifications, is the act of destroying the fixed supply. The entire purpose of Bitcoin is to fix the supply of money, and in doing so, solving a problem heretofore never solved, the double spending problem. At the heart of the double spending problem has always been theft, monetary value loss. One of the reasons the problem was never solved was because the problem was and remains poorly defined. Fixing the supply was the solution. If a fixed supply was the solution, the problem was an unfixed supply. The problem was inflation. For a double spend is simply an increase in supply, just the same as inflation is an increase in supply, or just as counterfeiting money is an increase in supply. The problem has always been finding ways to limit the supply of these monetary units. Quote, we define an electronic coin as a chain of digital signatures. Each owner transfers the coin to the next by digitally signing a hash of the previous transaction and the public key of the next owner, and adding these to the end of the coin. A payee can verify the signatures to verify the chain of ownership. The problem, of course, is the payee can't verify that one of the owners did not double spend the coin. A common solution is to introduce a trusted central authority, or mint, that checks every transaction for double spending. After each transaction, the coin must be returned to the mint to issue a new coin, and only coins issued directly from the mint are trusted not to be double spent. The problem with this solution is that the fate of the entire monetary system depends on the company running the mint, with every transaction having to go through them, just like a bank. We need a way for the payee to know that the previous owners did not sign any earlier transactions. For our purposes, the earliest transaction is the one that counts, so we don't care about later attempts to double spend. The only way to confirm the absence of a transaction is to be aware of all transactions. In the mint-based model, the mint was aware of all transactions and decided which arrived first. To accomplish this without a trusted party, transactions must be publicly announced, and we need a system for participants to agree on a single history of the order in which they were received. The payee needs proof that at the time of each transaction, the majority of nodes agreed it was the first received. From the section on transactions in the Bitcoin white paper. In order to limit the supply of the number of units, every user must have a record of all Bitcoin in supply, and from this supply, each user verifies that the units they hold, spend, and receive are in fact part of the total supply. To accomplish this process of record keeping and verification, units of Bitcoin are defined as unbroken strings or chains of transactions. To spend a Bitcoin is to add a transaction to the history of all transactions, to the chain of all transactions. The chains of transactions weave together in a unique tapestry that cannot be forged or faked with present-day or even theoretical computing power. In this way, the double spending problem is once and for all solved. Quote, the incentive can also be funded with transaction fees. If the output value of a transaction is less than its input value, the difference is a transaction fee that is added to the incentive value of the block containing the transaction. Once a predetermined number of coins have entered circulation, the incentive can transition entirely to transaction fees and be completely inflation-free. The second paragraph of the section on incentives in the Bitcoin white paper. Satoshi made it abundantly clear. The problem he was searching to solve was monetary debasement, quote, and be completely inflation-free. And he solved it by putting all the users of the money in control of the decision process to debase their own money. Human nature is such that no matter how bad some emergency situation might be, the situation will never be so bad that money alone can resolve the emergency. Money does not create things. People create things. If more food is needed, then more people will work to produce food. More money is never the best long-term solution. Satoshi understood this, and now you do too. Quote, we have proposed a system for electronic transactions without relying on trust. We started with the usual framework of coins made from digital signatures, which provides strong control of ownership, but is incomplete without a way to prevent double spending. To solve this, we proposed a peer-to-peer network using proof of work to record a public history of transactions that quickly becomes computationally impractical for an attacker to change if honest nodes control a majority of CPU power. The network is robust in its unstructured simplicity. Nodes work all at once with little coordination. They do not need to be identified since messages are not routed to any particular place and only need to be delivered on a best effort basis. Nodes can leave and rejoin the network at will, accepting the proof of work chain as proof of what happened while they were gone. They vote with their CPU power, expressing their acceptance of valid blocks by working on extending them and rejecting invalid blocks by refusing to work on them, any needed rules and incentives can be enforced with this consensus mechanism. From the Bitcoin white paper. The problem Satoshi solved was monetary value loss. The problem was an unfixed supply of monetary units. His solution, the only solution available, was to fix the supply of monetary units, to set a never-changing supply of units for all time. His solution is called Bitcoin. And those of us that run Bitcoin are Bitcoiners, plebs, and Bitcoin maximalists. Any needed rules and incentives to maintain this primary goal can be enforced with this consensus mechanism. Your altcoins and your CBDCs are of zero value to us. This is not a negotiation. To the VCs and scam artists, if you shill your shitcoins under the guise of a new and improved Bitcoin, you either don't understand Bitcoin or are willfully trying to scam those that do not understand it yet, and we will call you out on it, whether your intent is willful malice or otherwise. We do not care what your intent is. The double spend is solved. There is only one solution, a fixed supply. There is no ability to improve over a fixed supply. Suggesting so is ignorance at best, and we care not the intent. Educate on what Bitcoin is, or go f*** yourself. To the governments and overlords, if you force us to use your Fed coins under the threat of death, sure, we will use it. But we will not stop running our Bitcoin, and most certainly not stop under the threat of death. There are no possible circumstances that could force us to stop running Bitcoin. And when we say Bitcoin, we mean the 21 million hard cap monetary network. This is non-negotiable. Go f*** yourself. Alright, and that concludes our piece, 21 million is non-negotiable, by Zach of Earth. Let's take a quick break for our sponsor and we'll jump back in. Did you pay for something in fiat today and not get sats back? God, what's that like? It must be horrible. I don't have that problem because I use the Fold debit card and it gets me sats back on everything. I just crossed 9 million sats actually. I've moved my entire banking life over to Fold and understand that it's not a credit card that gives you sats back. It is a debit card. Now, a credit card you pay interest on. So many people don't realize this. If you get like 2% back on a credit card, but you're paying 20% interest and you don't pay everything off the second you spend it, you're not getting anything back. When you're paying at the end of the month, you're paying the extra percentage that they're rewarding you in credit card points. Fold is a debit card with a base 1% back on everything and a chance to win up to 100% back, and then you get even more sats back on the gift cards that they have to major retailers. And if you want to check them out, they have free sats. There's literally a daily spin wheel and you get sats for nothing. Just download the app, open it up, spin the wheel, you get sats. It's literally the first thing I do every single day. And the rewards are even better if you get the premium debit card. Simply put, this is the only sensible way to do fiat. If you don't get sats back, you're simply doing fiat wrong. Get the Fold card, get 20% off the annual fee, 20% off with code BITCOINAUDIBLE, all one word. Again, that's 20% off, guys. You gotta check that out. Start getting sats for free, then upgrade to the premium, because you know you're gonna do it. You won't regret it. Fold. So I was thinking about this piece, I don't even remember who recommended it, but somehow it showed up in my feed. But I got thinking about this piece specifically because it's come up. I ran into another thread on Twitter, and this comes up pretty commonly, or pretty frequently, I guess, that we need tail emission on Bitcoin. That and Peter Todd in particular has been a proponent of this for a very, very long time. That it would have been better if we had had some sort of constant inflation schedule on Bitcoin to quote-unquote fund the security of Bitcoin. And I've thought that was bad economics or poor thinking on the issue for a couple of different reasons. Now, you can't just say it's poor economics because Bitcoin is game theory on top of economics, right? It's not as if simply economic theory from the context of like markets will explain what you should do, what you should set out as policy in a protocol like Bitcoin. But the reason is because I think particularly when you think about the dynamics of the security model of Bitcoin and the attempt to censor Bitcoin, the subsidy is really kind of the worst part of it, almost. Like when you're looking at it from a 51% attack, either for censorship or to attack the network, the only real mechanism is that what your reward that you're getting out of it is denominated in the asset that you're attacking. So it is a pure cost. Now, you can argue, the argument is that the subsidy itself increases the reward and thus increases the amount of hash power going to protect the network. But there's also a flip side of that. Is the problem is that if you're attempting to censor the network, if you're attempting to control what transactions go through the network, the only thing that subsidizes those individuals is the block reward. It is the subsidy. It is the censor's payoff, is that they get paid whether they include transactions or not. So the fee market is irrelevant to them, which means that if we are never being run by the fee market, but instead we are being always run by the subsidy, there seems to be a long tail or a long-term, potentially deeply negative outcome of that, is that the transactions don't matter. And what's funny is, like, when you're looking at the idea of, are we going to be able to fund this thing with fees down the road? I actually think Ethereum is a decent example of why it's obvious that, yes, we will be able to do that. The issue is that you need to be able to make money with those transactions, make a return with those transactions that is greater than the cost of making those transactions. So the reason you actually have high fees sustained for any period of time on Ethereum is because you're gambling on shitcoins, is because you're getting inflation, quote-unquote, yield. You're getting a payout on DeFi of 10% or 20%, which is obviously impossible, and obviously the outcome of it is that it blows up and goes to zero or gets deleveraged, and you get this, you know, this circular logic of, like, I'm paying a lot of money to gamble, to make a lot of money on things that are just inflating a lot. But it indicates the economic issue of you need to be able to either be saving and or creating enough return with each transaction in order to fund the on-chain data for those transactions, which is why I think Lightning is kind of the key to finding a sustained market for fees on Bitcoin. But it requires massive liquidity, and it requires, you know, infrastructure around the globe. And that's why I also think it's good that we have 20 years of runway, maybe 30 years, really, if we're talking about the potential return on Bitcoin, in order to kind of establish this market. But I think it'll be established much, much sooner. And the reason is because the Lightning Network reference rate that Nick Bhatia talks about he's at Time Value of BTC, and he wrote Layered Money, a bunch of really great articles about the time cost or the time value of Bitcoin, a whole series actually. Really great. If you don't know Nick Bhatia, I mean, you should. I did his audiobook. I've read all of his pieces on the show, but just in case, check out Nick Bhatia. But I think that's actually a good model for understanding what the ultimate fees to be sustained on Bitcoin are, is that if you can economically, in a profitable manner, charge 1%, 2% APR or APY to handle liquidity on the Lightning Network, then it makes sense to essentially be able to pay 1% to 2% of the liquidity that you are asking for in transaction fees. I say that because profit tends to zero. Like that's how the market works, is that all profit will eventually just be zero. That's all the market conditions are, that if there is a profit, everybody packs in to get as much supply and production in the area of profit until the profit is gone, and then they have to withdraw and, you know, costs basically outweigh it, and you try to find that equilibrium until the conditions and the innovations and the environment of that market change, and you find a new area of profit. It's this constant chasing of destruction of profit. That's what the market does. So when you're looking at, oh, we're going to get 2% APY on Lightning Channel liquidity by offering up that liquidity to other nodes or whatever, well, that is only going to work as liquidity needs to be allocated, where it needs to be allocated. So where it is allocated, where there is no shift, it is going to tend towards zero, that margin, which means that if you're expecting to get 2% return, you can expect close to that being what you're willing to pay in order, what the market is willing to pay in order to get that 2% return, which means 2% of the liquidity on Lightning will likely be offered up in fees to establish Lightning liquidity. And the goal, the management of the Lightning Network and where things move to will be where yield is higher, right? It's where can you get more than that percentage, i.e. where is liquidity really needed, and who needs those payments, who can sell a lot of product, who has these new products that does not have liquidity, et cetera, et cetera. So that will be where the market arbitrage is where is liquidity already capitalized or already allocated, and where does it need to be allocated? And that's where you'll find the difference between that that return on the Lightning Network. And if you have that huge portion, if we have a really established Lightning Network and payment pools and payment channels, or channel factories, like all of these things that bolster out this global infrastructure for settling these payments, it's perfectly reasonable, I think, to expect or think that system, the liquidity in that system can handle 1-2% in fees for its value for the liquidity allocated in paying for the assurances of the base layer. But it will be after that infrastructure is built up, after that money needs to move and that liquidity establishes a market price, that you have enough. I mean, obviously, there needs to be way more channels on Lightning Network than a few blocks of Bitcoin can actually manage. And people talk about that like being like a really bad problem. And you can obviously think of a situation where maybe that would be an issue from some systemic complication with like the code or a major client or something like that, and the mass closing of channels. But when you think about it from the economics, is that you need that backlog so that you can fund the pressure, the block space pressure at the base layer, and the value, you increase the value of reallocating liquidity on Lightning. And what you have then when we actually transfer entirely over to fees, you actually have solved the problem of censorship at the base layer, because there's no longer any mechanism to fund censorship without the transactions, which means the transaction, if a transaction fee diverges between someone being censored and someone not being censored, there's no gap. Like, the subsidy is the gap that allows the censor to get away with it and still be profitable. If there is no gap, if it's purely that the censored transactions pay more than the uncensored transactions, or the ones that are, you know, deemed unworthy or deemed dangerous, whatever you want to call it, if that's the only difference, then that is purely the reward. A fee-based structure with a fixed supply is more secure in the long run. And then there's the fundamental issue, is that the ultimate value of Bitcoin, and then what Zach of Earth here is saying, is that the prime innovation of Bitcoin is the fixed supply. It's the inalterable monetary schedule. That is the breakthrough innovation of Bitcoin. That is what makes Bitcoin a revolutionary act. Like, the adoption of it, a revolutionary act, is the fact that you have adopted into an exact and predictable and incorruptible monetary schedule. This is how many Bitcoin there are. This is how many there will ever be. And nobody else can change that. That is fundamentally why Bitcoin as a digital unit has value of any kind. Everything else is secondary. The ability to transact it and to transact value with it is secondary. If you had an unlimited number of them and you could just make them at will, it doesn't matter how quickly they transact. It doesn't matter how many, the lack of third parties involved, it's still valueless. As I have said many times in the past, is that, you know, the ability to transact does not precede the value of it. The value of it must precede the transaction of value, because you can't exchange value if something doesn't have value in the first place, which is why you don't build payment networks that exchange shit that nobody wants. You know, we don't have Beanie Baby payment networks. We don't have payment networks that work in packets of dirt. Like, you, it doesn't make them more valuable because, oh, we can exchange them on this global infrastructure of decentralized payments. Now suddenly everybody wants more dirt. No. What you do is build payment networks and liquidity infrastructure for things that are valuable that people want to exchange. Now, I will push back on something in this article, because I can't decide if a fixed supply specifically, or if a fixed supply schedule is truly the invention here, is the innovation. Now, that does not diminish the enormity of the fact that Bitcoin has a fixed supply. That in and of itself is an incredible thing. And I think it's really important to note that that is what lends all of the power to the fixed supply schedule of Bitcoin. The fact that you can point and you know that 21 million equals Bitcoin. Like, that is a fundamentally powerful idea, and I think the simplicity of the monetary schedule, of the monetary reality of Bitcoin, is a huge, huge strength from a social and ideological, is not really the word, philosophical and just kind of like mental perspective. Simplicity, humans love simplicity, and things that are simple to understand are much easier to trust. And one of those things that has made Bitcoin, I think, incredibly powerful on the stage of ideas is that Bitcoin is 21 million, and compromising on that is absurd. I think it's absolutely retarded. There's a million different ways in which we can attempt to raise fees, or we can raise capacity on, like, I would be more in favor of a block size increase if for some reason I thought that that actually made more sense to get more fees and, you know, more on the base layer. I would be way, way more in favor of increasing the block size than I would of changing the supply. Now, of course, I think both of those things are stupid, and that I absolutely am against both of them. But nonetheless, supply is far higher on my hierarchy of needs, or hierarchy of critical importance of Bitcoin. Like, that is the value of Bitcoin, period, in my opinion. And that's why, you know, pieces like this get me, you know, thinking about this a lot. Like, 21 million equals Bitcoin. Bitcoin equals 21 million. It's just, that is how it's going to maintain value. If that ever breaks, I think that is the death of Bitcoin. So I think it's particularly in the context of double spending, like in what Zach of Earth is saying here in this piece, is that that fixed supply, that idea of not being able to change the schedule, of changing the monetary policy at all, that's the problem of double spending, right? Is changing the monetary supply outside of the monetary value, outside of the current structure of the supply schedule and the ownership. It's essentially altering the scarcity of the asset itself. And one of the excerpts he actually has from the white paper that I always thought was really powerful and has always been this kind of dilemma, this fundamental trade-off, because I'm also, like, privacy is also critically important to me. But the idea that, actually, let me just find the section specifically and I'll read it again. So in the context of preventing double spending is to know, is to be able to verify that double spending has not occurred and that there is a single history of Bitcoin transactions and that the Bitcoin supply limit has been enforced. Quote, we need a way for the payee to know that the previous owners did not sign any earlier transactions. For our purposes, the earliest transaction is the one that counts, so we don't care about later attempts to double spend. The only way to confirm the absence of a transaction is to be aware of all transactions. In the mint-based model, the mint was aware of all transactions, decided which arrived first. To accomplish with a trusted third party, without a trusted third party, we need a system for participants to agree on a single history in the order in which they received the payee's proof that at the time of the transaction, majority of nodes agreed it was first received. So, kind of the second half of that was unimportant. The major line that has always stuck with me and has bothered me on the privacy issue is that there is this trade-off between the supply schedule, between knowing and verifying 100% top to bottom that there are only 21 million Bitcoin and there are this exact amount of supply, is that that supply is visible. The quote was, the only way to confirm the absence of a transaction is to be aware of all transactions. And the only way to be aware, to be able to count that you are explicit part of an explicit supply, is to be able to see all of the supply. And there is that trade-off with certain types of transactions and types of privacy mechanisms that you want to be able to obscure the amounts. You want to be able to obscure who's transacting where. And therein lies a trade-off to the security, to the assurances of the money versus the assurances of the privacy involved. And you're adding some additional cryptographic primitive if you're trusting bullet proofs or something like that, like in something like confidential transactions. And then that increases the computation needed to even verify all of this stuff by a significant, significant margin. So there's a lot of back and forth, you know, explicit trade-offs between so many of these different mechanisms, but at the top of the hierarchy, the most critical part is 21 million, is the supply of Bitcoin, because that is what defines Bitcoin as a monetary unit. That is the backstop of all of its fundamental value and the fact that that cannot be changed and that that simply is. And it's fundamentally what has led to the solution of the double spend problem. Is that because we can guarantee that 21 million, that is proof that this double spend problem has been solved. That's just kind of confirmation of how the system, or that the system is working against the double spend problem. But one thing that has always stood out to me as potentially the prime innovation, I think that's the prime consequence of the innovation. So you could say that the fixed supply schedule is the thing that Bitcoin accomplishes. But I think the most beautiful element as to how Bitcoin accomplishes that specifically is actually in a section of the white paper that was also posted in this article. And this is just a line from the introduction, but this is the one that has always been kind of like the real power of Bitcoin to me. That is kind of hand in hand with the fixed supply. And I'll explain why in a second. So in this paper, we propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer distributed timestamp server to generate computational proof of the chronological order of transactions. And I think there is the true innovation of Bitcoin, that enables the fixed supply, that enables the proof that double spending, that the mechanism that allows the proof of that double spending has not occurred, and that ultimately this is about creating a digital clock. And this is why I love Dergigi's, and a number of other people have touched on this idea. Dergigi's probably just my favorite article about it. But it started from probably the earliest piece I heard this mentioned in was in Grisha's decentralized proof of work is a clock. No, how's that? How was it titled? It's blockchain proof of work is a decentralized clock. But that the most elegant and the impossible thing that Bitcoin did is its ability to tell time with computational proof. Using data that can be copied infinitely, that is in a distributed server on thousands of different computers, is able to prove an order of events. But that the only way to incentivize it, the only way that that order of events can be meaningful, is with a set of units that is limited in supply, and that is able to sustain a monetary premium, an economic value, in providing exactly that service. And this is actually another reason why I think the network effect of Bitcoin as a protocol and a technology is so unbelievably powerful, is because ultimately what it is doing is creating a value clock. It's creating a chronological history, a provable history of economic activity. It's a clock. It's a clock for economic exchange. And even talking about the convergences around a single monetary value, the convergences around single protocols, but now think about the convergence of time, is to try and sync, to try and coordinate activity without the same telling of time, the same assurance that something has even occurred in the past, is that that is going to converge even more. You know, like, for all the things that we do differ on, the different social media networks and the different computers and the different platforms and all of these different things, one of those fundamental things that we all have in common is that everybody's clock has 60 seconds on it. And why we don't go around making new clocks and new ways to tell time that compete with each other all the time. And there's one other thing, actually, that I saved from this piece that I just kind of wanted to clarify, because I think the wording misconstrued what I think the reality of the situation was. And it's about the nature of people always trying to increase the monetary supply and manipulate the money. And the beautiful thing about having a system where the users themselves have to debase themselves is that everybody's attempt to make money is necessarily at the benefit of the counterfeiter and the detriment of everyone else. So the idea of manipulating the money supply, the benefit of manipulating the money supply, it maybe is the better way to put it, only comes from being the only one who can do it, from explicitly being a cantillionaire, from having the special privilege that no one else has access to. It's like if I had a tree, like money grew in trees, right? If I had a tree that would grow money, it would be insanely profitable for me. If everybody who had a tree that grew on money would just be worthless and nobody would give a shit about the tree. You would just burn it, right? The advantage of manipulating the money supply rests entirely in the idea that you're the only one who can do it, or that only you and a small group of people can, and that you have your little club and that everybody else isn't in it. The second you leave it up to all of the users, to the entire network, as to whether or not we debase the currency, there's no special privilege anymore. There's no single individual who can benefit because they can't change it on everyone else. That is why the game theory aligns that no one would debase. And then there's a line that Zach of Earth has from this piece that says, quote, human nature is such that no matter how bad some emergency situation might be, the situation will never be so bad that money alone can resolve the emergency. Money does not create things, people create things. Now, the reason I point that out is because I think this sentence is kind of misconstruing the problem. It's exactly right that no matter how bad an emergency situation can be, it will never be so bad that the money alone, manipulating the money can resolve the emergency. But I don't think this is what Zach meant, just so you know, but the way it's worded suggests that the money does help in some way, or that it helps some, or that in some situations it can help more than others. And that's simply not true. So I don't want that to be misunderstood. The fundamental economic truth is that manipulating the money can do nothing at all. Nothing at all to resolve the emergency. For the exact same reason you can't write the word food on a napkin and then feed somebody with it. All you did was ruin a napkin and use up some ink. And I think that's what he was getting at with the second part, is that money does not create things, people create things. But the idea of money is an allocating mechanism. To manipulate the money does nothing to solve an emergency or change fundamentally what is happening in the world. What it does is cover up the economic reality of where and how resources have been broken or supply has broken down. You're screwing with the supply and demand curve such that your price no longer tells you anything meaningful about the economy. It's saying, how do we fix our budget for our house? Well, let's just cook the books and make it look like we have a profit. So to say that you can fix some sort of economic emergency by manipulating the money is similar to saying, like, let's say we have a minute by minute or second by second, like, open market for the value of houses, right? It's just trading markets. And your house catches on fire. And so the value of your house is falling. Manipulating the money to solve an economic crisis is like thinking that you can put out the house fire by going on Zillow and making a fake bid on your own house to prop up its value. And that because the value isn't falling, that means the house is not burning. I hope it's self-evident that that's very, very stupid. And the only reason that it appears to solve, that any of these economic problems actually get solved, is because of the millions and millions and millions of people that restructure, that sell, that buy, that shift, that actually allocate real resources. All of those things are the only reason that it gets solved. Manipulating the money does nothing but throw molasses. It throws, you know, it's like piss in a gas tank. You're just destroying the very mechanism they need to know what they need to do in response to the fire, to the emergency. And the only people who actually benefit from the manipulation are the people who the manipulation is in favor of. Who gets the handout, who gets the loan before everybody else, who is the cantillionaire in the cooking the books scenario. The value of Bitcoin is that you can't cook the books. It's that we know exactly how many there are and thus how much of it we have in comparison to the whole. And the fact that that schedule is fixed, that that supply never will never go past 21 million, is one of the most simple proofs of value and proof that Bitcoin does what it says it does that we could have. And because of that, I agree 100% with Zach of Earth. We also had a piece, actually, I think, of the exact same title by Phil Geiger in the past. We've covered this topic a lot, but it's always fun to bring it back around. 100% without question, 21 million is non-negotiable. With that, let's close this one out. I want to thank Swan Bitcoin and the Fold app for bringing this show to everybody and to letting me do this every single day. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.